Following are comments on William Shakespeare's Richard II, Act 5. Hath Bolingbroke deposed thine intellect? Richard's queen, Isabella of Valois, is dismayed at her husband's passivity. Richard, who will be lodged at Pomfret Castle, warns Northumberland about the fickleness of destiny and friends. In Act 5, Scene 1, Queen Isabella of Valois tries to revive Richard's spirits, but she finds it impossible. This scene between a well-matched husband and wife is pure imagination on Shakespeare's part, since Isabella was not yet 10 years old in September of 1399, the year and month in which this last part of the play is set. Richard's Isabella, then, may be patterned somewhat after Marlowe's portrait of Queen Isabella of France, the wife of the ill-fated King Edward II. Queen Isabella of Valois makes known her dismay at how abject Richard has become, asking him, quote-unquote, "Hath Bolingbroke deposed thine intellect?" Act 5, Scene 1, lines 27 through 28. But by this time, Richard is most concerned that his sad story become a royal winter's tale. He has already transitioned into a melancholy, reflective post-reign mode and is trying to imagine a time beyond the span of his life. He suggests to the queen, quote-unquote, "Tell thou the lamentable fall of me and send the hearers weeping to their beds." Act 5, Scene 1, lines 44 through 45. In this way, she will keep his memory alive, at least among the company she keeps by the fireside. Richard's eloquence never truly deserts him, as we see when he goes on to say to Isabella, quote-unquote, "The senseless brands will sympathize the heavy accent of thy moving tongue, and in compassion weep the fire out." Act 5, Scene 1, lines 46 through 48. It is worth asking how much compensation Richard's evergreen eloquence brings him in his ordeal of grief and loss. Perhaps this is an unanswerable question, but it arises because Shakespeare shows a strong and consistent interest in the many uses of language as well as in its limits. Richard, about to be sent to Pomfret rather than the Tower, exchanges some pointed words with the new king Henry IV's ally, Northumberland, also known as Henry Percy. He calls Percy the, quote-unquote, "ladder wherewithal the mounting Bolingbroke ascends my throne." Act 5, Scene 1, lines 55 through 56. He further predicts that this great lord who so strongly supported the new king's violent usurpation of the throne will soon distrust Henry IV, just as Henry IV will come to consider him a deadly enemy. Neither man will trust the other. Northumberland is unfazed and responds, quote-unquote, "My guilt be on my head, and there an end." Act 5, Scene 1, line 69. It's time for Richard to go to Pomfret Castle and his young queen to France. "To Bolingbroke are we sworn subjects now." Bolingbroke rides to his coronation in October 1399 with Richard in tow. York affirms his loyalty to the new king, and when he discovers a paper proving his son O'Merle's membership in a plot to kill Henry IV, he races to court to warn Henry. In Act 5, Scene 2, the Duke of York describes the coronation procession of Henry Bolingbroke. While he is sympathetic to Richard II, York knows it's time to show his loyalty for the incoming sovereign. His stance is hardly heroic, but it's undeniably practical. He says, quote-unquote, "To Bolingbroke are we sworn subjects now, whose state and honor I for aye allow." Act 5, Scene 2, lines 39 through 40. As we say today, nothing succeeds like success. Those who have the most to gain and lose generally back the politician who can provide security. The Duke of York's description of Bolingbroke in procession to Westminster is astute, as he relates the sight to his wife, the Duchess. Quote-unquote, "You would have thought the very windows spake, so many greedy looks of young and old through the casements darted their desiring eyes upon his visage." Act 5, Scene 2, lines 12 through 15, it seems as if almost the whole population of London has pinned its hopes on the new king's success, and York's account makes him sound like a medieval rock star. Henry Bolingbroke, as Shakespeare portrays him, is an accomplished politician. As Bolingbroke rides towards his coronation, Richard's sad role is to serve as the cleanup act. He shows almost Christ-like patience in this new role. York describes the ex-monarch's fate as follows, quote unquote, "As in a theater the eyes of men, after a well-graced actor leaves the stage, are idly bent on him that enters next, thinking his prattle to be tedious. So it goes with Richard of Bordeaux." Act 5, Scene 2, lines 23 through 26. The crowd even throws dust on his head, but he suffers it all without any display of anger. But now a potential domestic disaster looms for the Duke of York when he discovers, however implausibly, on his son O'Merle's person, a document directly implicating the young man in a treasonous plot to assassinate Henry IV. Brushing aside the pleas of his wife, the Duchess, with almost comic brusqueness, York sets out to warn the king, even though it means condemning his own son, something he seems eager to do. "Can no man tell me of my unthrifty son?" King Henry IV longs for good news about Prince Hal. Soon, the wayward O'Merle enters Henry's chamber to beg for a pardon, and then York and the Duchess arrive and plead, respectively, for condemnation and mercy. Henry pardons O'Merle, but will pursue the other conspirators. We hear King Henry IV's first mention of his troublesome son, Prince Hal, who will someday become one of England's most celebrated kings for his victory at Agincourt in 1415. But just at the moment, the king's fond hopes for the young roustabout seem misplaced, and he desperately wants to hear from his lords some good news about the lad. He asks them, quote unquote, "Can no man tell me of my unthrifty son?" Act 5, Scene 3, Line 1. By the king's own telling, Hal, quote unquote, "daily doth frequent with unrestrained loose companions." Act 5, Scene 3, lines 6 through 7. The distraught father calls his absentee son a, quote unquote, "young, wanton, and effeminate boy." Act 5, Scene 3, line 10. This is hardly what a king hopes for in his future successor. We are no doubt being asked to understand that Bolingbroke's anxiety stems from the possibility that Prince Hal will turn out to be as reckless and irresponsible as Richard II, the man his father has just deposed. The action that ensues is essentially comic, with the Duke of York adopting an attitude similar to that of the severe ancient Roman nobleman who, in the historian Livy's recounting, executed his own son rather than mitigate just punishment for the young man's crimes against the state. His wife, the Duchess of York, kneels for the principle that any mother must have tender feelings towards her child, and that those feelings must be respected. Confronted with this spectacle, which would make pretty good modern reality TV, what does King Henry do? He generously sides with the Duchess and with O'Merle, although he decrees the execution of, quote unquote, "the rest of that consorted crew." Act 5, Scene 3, line 138. Apparently, now that the feckless Richard II has been deposed, Henry plans to preside over a kinder, gentler royal court in England. The reign of King Henry IV lasted from late September 1399 to his death in March 1413. "Have I no friend will rid me of this living fear?" Sir Piers Exton, an ambitious knight, hears King Henry IV wish aloud that Richard of Bordeaux were no longer around to threaten him, and decides to carry out Henry's wish. In Act 5, Scene 4, like Henry II against Thomas à Becket a few centuries back in 1170, King Henry IV voices his desire to be rid of the man whose continued existence troubles him, Richard of Bordeaux. And like Henry II, Henry IV is overheard by a supporter eager to do his bidding. This time, it's the knight Sir Piers Exton, who hears the king say twice, "Have I no friend will rid me of this living fear?" Act 5, Scene 4, Line 2. The similarity of the two kings' conduct indicates rough sailing ahead for the conscience of Henry IV. Henry II, students of history may recall, is said to have felt so guilty about Becket that he ended up donning sackcloth and having himself scourged through the streets of London. "I wasted time, and now doth time waste me." Imprisoned at Pomfret Castle, Richard meditates on ambition, misfortune, and death. A stable groom visits him, along with the prison warder. Sir Piers Exton and his thugs enter armed, and in the ensuing fight, Richard is stabbed to death by Exton. In Act 5, Scene 5, the penultimate scene of Richard II, Shakespeare provides a well-rounded dramatic conclusion to the fallen King Richard II's life, one that has more to do with the playwright's imagination and audience expectations. In Act 5, Scene 5, the penultimate scene of Richard II, Shakespeare provides a well-rounded dramatic conclusion to the fallen King Richard II's life. He borrows the basic idea from Holinshed's Chronicles that Richard was murdered by Piers Exton, but there is no historical evidence that this is how Richard actually died. When we see the former king at the beginning of Scene 5, his speech is true to character. Quote unquote, "I have been studying how to compare this prison where I live unto the world, and for because the world is populous, and here is not a creature but myself, I cannot do it. Yet I'll hammer it out." Act 5, Scene 5, Lines 1 through 5. So sits Richard of Bordeaux in his cell at Pomfret, philosophizing about himself, his surroundings, and the world. This is his particular way of practicing the medieval art of dying well, ars moriendi. He examines the notion that so many other disgraced actors in the world have hit upon, which is simply that, quote unquote, "They are not the first of fortune's slaves, nor shall not be the last." Act 5, Scene 5, Lines 24 through 25. As always, Richard regards himself as an actor, so his take on this time-worn idea is, quote unquote, "Thus play I in one prison many people, and none contented." Act 5, Scene 5, Lines 31 through 32. The sum of such exercises, Richard finds, is not much compensation, but rather a melancholy admission that, quote unquote, "Nor I, nor any man that but man is, with nothing shall be pleased, till he be eased with being nothing." Act 5, Scene 5, Lines 39 through 41. Only death puts an end to suffering and to speculation of the sort that is dear to Richard. Even the best of his reflections won't compose him, won't give him peace or produce any change in his final predicament. Richard has been, above all, he suggests, a waster of time, and he recognizes too late that time is bound to waste the waster in return. Quote unquote, "I wasted time, and now time doth waste me, for now hath time made me his numbering clock." Act 5, Scene 5, Lines 49 through 50. For Richard, as we follow his metaphor, time no longer flows like the sand in an hourglass. It is measured in and on his body like the movements of a ticking clock, and the passage of time's units consists of, quote unquote, "sighs and tears and groans," all while Henry Bolingbroke goes about his kingly affairs. Act 5, Scene 5, Line 57. The temporal figure Richard uses may be peculiar to him, but there is something typical about his musings at this point, an air or attitude that makes him sound like one of the ghostly speakers in The Mirror for Magistrates, with their sententiae summing up the value of a life and the cost of grave mistakes. It is clear that Richard, though humbled, is unable to arrive at the patience he seeks. He holds a brief conversation with a stable groom who used to dress the horse that Richard rode, only to see it bear Bolingbroke to glory. This is the last sympathetic voice that Richard hears, though, as the young man is ushered out by the keeper, who so angers the former king by refusing to sample his food that he earns for it an outburst and a beating, quote-unquote. The devil take Henry of Lancaster and thee. Act 5, Scene 5, Line 102. Moments later, Richard's murderers make their entrance, and the ex-king dies courageously, even killing some of his assassins. Exton reminds us of the theological dimensions of what has just happened when he realizes he has purchased nothing but damnation by doing the new king's bidding. Quote unquote, "Oh, would the deed were good, for now the devil that told me I did well says that this deed is chronicled in hell." Act 5, Scene 5, Lines 114 through 116. The historical date of Richard's death was February 14th, 1400. "I protest my soul is full of woe, that blood should sprinkle me to make me grow. While some of Henry's enemies are captured and executed, he pardons Bishop Carlisle. Exton brings Richard's corpse to Henry, only to be banished for his regicidal act. Henry declares that he means to go on a crusade to the Holy Land to assuage his guilt." In Act 5, Scene 6, King Henry IV sums up the situation as it now stands. "Rebels have burned Chichester in Gloucester to the ground, but right away in comes Northumberland, Henry Percy, to tell him that the main would-be assassins, the so-called Oxford conspirators who signed O'Merle's letter, have been captured and executed. Percy tells him, quote unquote, "I have to London sent the heads of Salisbury, Spencer, Blunt, and Kent." Act 5, Scene 6, Lines 7 through 8. Fitzwater adds a few more traitors to the list, Brockus and Sir Bennet Seely. As of early 1400, the new king, Henry IV, has work to do in putting down rebellions against him, disorders that will stretch forward to around 1408, and that begin with the Oxford conspiracy that threatened to end his reign as soon as it began. Just now, however, Henry distributes honors to his supporters and pardons the Bishop of Carlisle, establishing a precedent of generosity and gratitude over against Richard II's venal, selfish, and corrupt administration. Exton, remover of Henry's worst fear, is rewarded only with his own guilt as the assassin of an anointed king. Henry curses him with the words, quote unquote, "With Cain go wander through the shade of night, and never show thy head by day nor light." Act 5, Scene 6, Lines 42 through 43. The new king's response to Exton's atrocity is, of course, hypocritical, and yet somehow genuine. Henry believes that this poison was necessary, but hates the poisoner, and still has some regard for the one poisoned. Richard was, after all, his cousin, and the two had known each other since childhood. Act 5, Scene 6, Line 38. The play ends with King Henry IV in a penitent mood, declaring openly his grief, quote unquote, "that blood should sprinkle me to make me grow." Act 5, Scene 6, Line 46. What he is now confronting is the brutal proto-Machiavellian truth that not only must a king deal with maintaining his two bodies in a productive relationship, but that even the supposedly glorious corporate symbolic body that is the monarchy itself is often obtained and kept by the bloodiest and most impure means. Understandably, then, the stricken King Henry IV desperately wants to lead a crusade to retake Jerusalem to expiate his guilt, but as it will turn out, he has far too much on his plate to indulge himself in the luxury of self-reproach, to borrow a phrase from Oscar Wilde. Although Henry had undertaken religion-based travels, an expedition to Lithuania to aid the Teutonic Knights in 1390, and then in 1392, a pilgrimage to Jerusalem before he became king, He never did undertake a crusade during his reign, which lasted from late 1399 to 1413. If there is to be renewal in this Lancastrian dynasty, it will come only with the maturing of Henry IV's son Prince Hal, who is still a tavern goer and an actor trying on many parts. In 1 and 2 Henry IV, the prince's role-playing is redeemed because it differs profoundly in its purpose from the self-absorbed, poetical, and dramatic inclinations that consumed Richard II and ultimately made him unfit to govern. This audio lecture was recorded on Wednesday, October 8th, 2025. The foregoing material is copyright 2025 by Alfred J. Drake. For quotations, I have relied on the Norton Shakespeare's third edition, four-volume, genre-based format.